We're taking this with a pinch of salt.
Dear colleagues, I'm Dr. George Kosmadakis, the today's host of ERA podcast, A Pinch of Salt. Every hypotensive episode during dialysis is seriously affecting the circulation of all the vital organs. It is a mini heart attack, a mini stroke, even a mini mesenteric artery ischemia. Intradialytic hypotension is associated with lots of very bad clinical outcomes, and yet we are confused with a multitude of probable interventions, validated or not, scientifically proven or not. Today, we have the honor and the pleasure to host one of the biggest researchers and clinicians on the subject, Professor Andrew Davenport from University College of London, UK. He has participated in numerous studies on intradialytic hypotension and is a world authority on dialysis issues. Andrew, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you much for the invitation, George.
So I will straight away start with a seemingly simple question that all young doctors, and when I was a young registrar, I was asking, but I didn't dare to ask the more experienced professionals. So it was an internal discussion between registrars. How can somebody define intradialytic hypotension?
Well, it is a very difficult subject, actually, George. So I think what you have to accept is that we treat a range of patients. So particularly in Europe and North America, we're treating older patients. And so we have patients who come into dialysis with high blood pressures and those that come in with low blood pressures. And that's why when some years ago in the UK, we tried to introduce potential standards for what should be pre-dialysis blood pressure and what should be post-dialysis blood pressure, we ran into problems. And I think that when I look at the situation, my feeling is that I tend to go back to what was the European best practice guideline of a fall in systolic blood pressure of about 20 millimeters of mercury or a drop of 10 millimeters of mercury. But I don't include the other part of their definition, which was the patients had to have symptoms. Now, I'll come back to this about not having symptoms. There are other, obviously, definitions in terms of whether patient's systolic blood pressure falls below 100 or falls below 90, according to what their pre-dialysis blood pressure was. But one of the key issues here is the pre-dialysis blood pressure. So some years ago, Sandeep Mitra, before he became professor of renal medicine in Manchester, did a study where he was measuring blood pressure. And he very simply just measured blood pressure of patients who come into the dialysis unit at the start of dialysis, towards the end of dialysis, and then 20 minutes or so after dialysis. And you get all sorts of different blood pressure readings. And so one of the things that we've learned over the years is that the pre-dialysis blood pressure probably does not reflect the person's true blood pressure. And so therefore, one of the issues is that when we talk about what is a fall in blood pressure, the question is, well, really, what was the baseline blood pressure? And that's where it becomes very difficult. And I think that's where a lot of the definitions have had problems. So to me, a fall of blood pressure about 20 millimeters of mercury, I think, does have effects. And I'll come back to that later in the conversation.
Right. So you consider as a most important factor the reduction of blood pressure during dialysis session.
Yes. But I think the issues are you have to try and standardize the pre-dialysis blood pressure. So you are dealing with what I call the patient's real blood pressure. And not the blood pressure, you know, because obviously when patients arrive to dialysis, they could be excited, they could be frustrated, etc. And therefore, the blood pressure may be a bit higher than it normally is. So I think that's one of the considerations you have to take into account.
So you advise us to consider as baseline blood pressure, probably the blood pressure after a few minutes of dialysis?
So when Sandeep Mitra looked at patients, what he found was that a blood pressure taken about 20 minutes after dialysis session was very similar to that during the interdialytic interval when he compared it to 24 and 48 hour blood pressure measurements. Obviously, if you have access to interdialytic blood pressures, then that to me then becomes what the patient's blood pressure is. So what we often ask patients to do is, can you take your blood pressure at home on a non-dialysis day? preferably take it in the morning, do it at the kitchen table. So you're sitting with your blood pressure machine roughly at the left of your heart. Take it once, wait a minute, 2 minutes, take it a second time. If the two readings are roughly the same, that's fine. If there is a drop in the second reading, then wait another 2 minutes, take a third reading, take the average of the two lower readings. And that gives us what we call a baseline blood pressure. So what we're really talking about is a drop in, say, 20 millimeters of mercury from that baseline blood pressure.
Right. So here you, it's a very important thing that you include ambulatory blood pressure measurements in the paradigm of the definition of the intradialytic hypotension, because as you say, you have to have a baseline, and the best baseline is probably ambulatory measurements. Yeah, that's very interesting. Because we have seen in a lot of studies that you said some researchers defined it as a blood pressure under 90 during dialysis, whereas there are a lot of patients who basically this is their blood pressure at home, and the presence of symptoms is a very important factor. So how in your clinics would you define definitely? Do you ask all people measure their blood pressure at home, and after you consider a drop as an intradialytic hypotension, or you are taking into account the presence of symptoms?
So I don't particularly take into account the presence of symptoms. I'm really talking about an actual finite drop in blood pressure. And
Right.
let me come back to the symptoms issue. One of the reasons I became interested in this was that some years ago, we did a study with our psychologists looking at psychometric testing of dialysis patients. And the study had a very simplistic idea, and that was we take a patient on hemodialysis. They have uremic toxins. Their psychometric testing will show their higher mental functions are impaired. We then transplant the patient. Urea and creatinine fall, levels of uremic toxins drop in the brain, and their psychometric testing improves. Very simple. And the answer to that question was yes, that happened, as you'd expect. But what we found was that in patients who'd been dialyzing in our center for more than 3 years, there was no improvement. And here we are, we're taking the better patients, the healthier patients, the patients we're selecting for transplantation. And yet, in 3 years, we've caused significant permanent damage to their brain that it doesn't improve. High mental function don't get better after 3 years of dialysis. And that to me was a very worrying message. And then I got our imaging team to make some reconstructive three-dimensional images of the brain of some of my dialysis patients. And you know, one of those Swiss cheeses that has all those holes in it.
Yeah.
Suddenly, these were the pictures that were coming back from these three-dimensional imaging of active parts of the brain. And this to me was worrying. And these were patients where we record on our computerized systems whether patients need a reduction in ultrafiltration, et cetera, whether they've had to been laid with feet up in the air or whatever, any nursing interventions. And yet, generally, these patients that went into this study didn't have a record of what I call symptomatic hypotension. And therefore, it struck me that possibly just asymptomatic falls in blood pressure are important. You know, we've known for years that what there's a tenfold increase or something of that amount in terms of stroke, particularly ischemic stroke. And we know that from MRI scans, you see all these small changes in the white matter around the ventricle areas of the brain. And this presumably is due to the two issues of A, we get a degree of swelling of the brain with hemodialysis, the osmotic effects, and then we also get this reduction in blood supply to the brain. Now, historically, we've always said, oh, well, the brain's auto-regulated, et cetera. But we're dealing with an older population. Certainly in the UK, over 40% of patients on hemodialysis are now diabetic. So we're dealing with a group of patients where autoregulation doesn't particularly work. And so these, what appear to be asymptomatic falls in blood pressure, I do think have an actual effect, particularly on the brain. And we know from the States, where the whole ethos of dialysis is to hit a KTOV in a short time, that we know that elderly people seem to deteriorate functionally quite quickly in the first 6 months of starting dialysis. So we do think this is important in terms of trying to prevent drops in blood pressure during dialysis. But as I said before, we have to need to know what we think is the baseline blood pressure to understand the drop.
Thank you very much. It's a wonderful thing that you answered to the next question that I would ask you, which is the impact of intradialytic hypertension. You confirm that actually even asymptomatic drops are responsible for mini strokes, mini heart attacks, mini mesenteric artery ischemias with a lot of uremic toxins that are liberated from the intestine. So I think it's clear now how deleterious is this intradialytic hypertension. And I would like you to ask you if you could explain a little bit in more detail the potential mechanisms of why people are presenting this intradialytic hypertension. Is it only the ultrafiltration or?
Well, I think if we go back to very basics, I mean, if you think about it, what are we actually measuring when we measure blood pressure? We're measuring the tone in the blood vessel wall. Okay, so what governs the tone in the blood vessel wall? Well, first of all, the pressure inside, the internal pressure. So you're right, volume. Okay, so yes, so in one aspect, we are removing fluid from the plasma space, but we know that generally patients, in terms of where is the fluid expansion between one dialysis session and the next, and it's mainly intracellular with some additional extracellular fluid that's outside the plasma compartment. So really, it's a matter of how is fluid being withdrawn from the cells and outside the blood space into the plasma volume. So one is, how is the patient refilling? That's question one. And we'll come back to that in a second. And the other issue is in terms of how blood is distributed inside the body. So one of the big issues is that as patients get connected to a hemodialysis machine, there are changes in terms of how blood is distributed in the body. So blood is closed down in terms of the circulation of the skin, in terms of muscle, et cetera. So there's a redistribution. So the question then is, what governs that redistribution of blood? Well, most of it we think is sympathetic nervous system derived and is also related to their cardiovascular reserve. Now, in most patients, we can't affect cardiovascular reserve. That's what the patient brings to the dialysis machine. But the issues are, can we improve sympathetic tone? That's question one, in terms of how it affects redistribution. If we were to, let's say, for the sake of argument, to lie a patient flat, then we're going to get better redistribution of blood into the central circulation than if we have the patient sitting upright. So there are sort of simple things like that we can think about. In terms of how can we mobilize fluid from different spaces? So that then depends on things like osmotic forces, inflammation, endothelial leak, etc. Now, so what we're now getting at is that if we have a patient who's septic, they'll have a greater endothelial leak. There'll be more albumin outside the circulation. So they're going to have more difficulty in terms of refilling. And so when we look at our own practice, where do we find more hypotension? Well, obviously, when we're dialyzing patients who are admitted acutely to the hospital who need dialysis. So patients with sepsis. So there's that issue in terms of refilling. What else provides the tone internally? Well, what about the viscosity of the blood? So what are the key aspects in terms of viscosity of blood? Well, hematocrit. So if we're going to try and dialyze somebody with a hemoglobin of 60 grams per liter, they have a greater risk of hypotension than if we dialyze somebody with a hematocrit or hemoglobin of 100 grams per liter. So there are issues of how we can think, particularly in the acute situation, to try and reduce hypotension. And again, then the issue is, well, what about protein content? Because that's, again, going to have an effect in terms of tonicity. So again, a patient who is severely hypoalbuminemic is going to be greater risk of intradialytic hypotension than somebody with a normal albumin level. And then thirdly, sodium. So sodium is something that we can alter. Now, as we all know, in the acute situation, in the hospital situation, we can control sodium intake into the patient. So we almost have a free range of changing the dialysate sodium to increase the dialysate sodium to try and counteract effects in terms of osmosis and trying to improve tissue refilling. In the chronic situation, obviously, we don't normally have that luxury because we obviously have patients who might be eating a large amount of salt between dialysis sessions. but again, it's something to think about in terms of how we can try and maintain tone. The next issue then is, what about the tone of the vessel wall itself? So if we think about, well, what is going to cause stiffness in the arterial wall? And that could be the sodium content of the wall, and also the calcium content of the wall. Now, in those cases, that means that the wall might be stiff and can't actually constrict down to help us prevent hypotension. So that could be a factor that increases the risk of intradiabetic hypotension. And then outside the wall, we've got things like sympathetic nervous system activity. So how can we activate that? So we can activate that by making or cooling down the dial state. That's one way of activating the sympathetic nervous system drive to increase tonicity. We can think about drugs which can affect tonicity of the wall. So we know from one of the large studies in the UK, when we looked at drugs that was possibly linked to intradiabetic hypotension, we found that prescribing potent alpha blockers prior to a dialysis session, or taking potent alpha blockers prior to dialysis session, was associated with increased risk of hypotension. And there's data, I think, from the States suggesting that one of the beta blockers that's not removed by dialysis also seemed to increase the risk of hypotension. So there are issues in terms of possibly drugs that we can use in our clinical practice, which may increase or potentially increase the risk of hypotension. And then equally, there are drugs such as midodrine, which by reducing noradrenaline uptake may reduce the risk. So, you know, there are a series of steps we can think about in terms of why patients are more at risk of hypotension compared to others. And then the issues then is, again, what does the patient bring to the dialysis machine? So if we have a patient with a low cardiac output, they're much more susceptible to the risk of hypotension than somebody who has a normal cardiac output or a high cardiac output. And, you know, if you think about who is going to have a low cardiac output, well, so my team this morning were discussing a patient with been admitted with acute scleroderma crisis. Well, someone in acute scleroderma crisis will have a very low cardiac output. If you put them on a hemodialysis machine, they're very likely to become profoundly hypotensive. Somebody with constrictive pericarditis, severe aortic stenosis in such a way, there may be a low cardiac output. Paradoxically, most patients with heart failure actually have a normal or raised cardiac output. It's only those with right ventricular dysfunction, pulmonary hypertension, who are more at risk, etc. So there are, say, patient-related factors, and then other factors related to the tonicity of the vessel. And we can alter quite a lot of those.
That's thank you very much for this for this list of measures that you are proposing to avoid these episodes. And I would like a small comment, if you may, concerning all these retrocontrol systems that we have in our dialysis machines lately, where we can adjust and personify the ultrafiltration rate and the conductivity of the dialysis machine. What's your opinion about these tools?
Well, okay. The simplest one that we use is relative blood volume monitoring.
Yeah.
Which we use as standard of care of all our inpatient dialysis. And what's really interesting there is to look at what happens in the first 15, 20 minutes as patients go on to the dialysis machine. And you can see there as to that gives you a very good idea of how the patient is tolerating the dialysis machine in those first 15, 20 minutes. And you will see a number of patients where there's quite a marked fall in relative blood volume monitoring. And so in those patients, you can then take preemptive actions to try and prevent hypotension by changing the dialysate sodium. We may change the temperature. We may switch from post-dilutional hemodiac filtration to pre-dilutional hemodiac filtration to increase cooling, etc. So I think that's very helpful in the acute situation. There is a cost. There is a financial cost. And so it may not be something you can do in all your outpatient hemodialysis sessions. But possibly if you have patients where you think they're at risk, then it may be worthwhile doing that. In terms of what I call the fuzzy logic machines, one of the issues to remember, though, with relative blood volume monitoring is there is a concept called the Ferris effect. And Ferris was an Austrian physiologist. And essentially what he looked at is to do, again, in terms of viscosity. So if you think about blood supply to capillaries, because a capillary is very small, the hematocrit has to be lower to get the blood flow. Otherwise, the capillary would get clogged, as you get, say, with malaria. And so initially, the body responds to ultrafiltration by closing down small blood vessels. So that means that the blood coming back to the central pool is slightly dilute. And therefore, what you are seeing in terms of relative blood volume monitoring, you're seeing a change, but it's a delayed change. And in part, that's why some of the fuzzy logic systems which people have tried to develop to try and then control or sort of regulate ultrafiltration rates and sodium conductivity have not stopped intradilated hypotension. They've tended to reduce severe episodes, but not obviously removed it. And so there are other issues to think about. And so one of the things that we've been interested in recently is by looking at changes in volumes in different compartments by using bioimpedance to see if there's an imbalance in terms of how fluid is being returned into the central pool. Now, the problem with bioimpedance is it can tell you whether fluid's intracellularly or extracellularly, but it can't tell you whether it's actually inside the vascular compartment. But again, it gives an insight. And so I think that in the future, we will start to have technology that will help us identify patients who are at risk and provide and then start preventive strategies to try and reduce the risk of hypotension in those individuals. And I can see that coming in the next few years.
I wouldn't imagine a better conclusion of our scientific or the scientific part of the discussion with this very optimistic message that you have to pass, and that was wonderful. Now I will conclude our discussion with a couple of more personal questions. We would like to know the Andrew. Behind Professor Andrew Davenport, and I would like to ask you if you were in a on a desert island, which book, luxury item, and two songs would you take with you?
Well, I'd actually think about that. And I've decided that as a book, I would take the work of Shakespeare. I think because to keep you amused, you have to have a book that you can keep going back and reading bits and coming away and reading bits. And I think reading Shakespeare's plays, because actually, if you actually sit down, they're actually quite witty, some of them. But it takes a little while to understand the wit behind them. So I think that would be the book. In terms of the luxury item, well, I like scuba diving, so I'd like to take my scuba diving kit
Ah.
and possibly a spear gun so I can go and catch some fish as well to eat, all right?
Oh, that's a very useful luxury item, actually.
That's right. I need the oxygen compressor, though, obviously, to keep being able to dive under the water. Yeah.
Wonderful. What about the two songs?
Yeah, I've thought about that. So I think probably Down in a Tube Station After Midnight by The Jam reminds me of my younger days when I was a medical student in London. And I was born and raised in a city called Liverpool. And I think probably You'll Never Walk Alone by Jerry and the Pacemakers.
Oh, of course, of
Yeah.
course. That's oh, a very Liverpoolian song in the heart of London.
That's right, yeah.
Well, we know everybody has been to London, and it's a wonderful city. But we visited as tourists, and I would like to ask you if you could tell us a secret about London from a
Well,
Londoner.
okay, it's not really a secret, but it might be something that you may or may not be aware of. So in England, we had a civil war back in the 1600s. And the king that came in after the civil war was the son of the king that we executed, Charles I. So he was Charles II. And he noticed that in the Tower of London, which was essentially a castle built by the Normans when they conquered England back in 1066, there is a main component of that called the White Tower. And he noticed in the White Tower there were a number of ravens. And so he started this hypothesis that provided the ravens stayed in the White Tower, the crown of England was safe and England would not be conquered.
Ah.
And so in the Tower of London, there are some, inverted commas, guards or warders, which wear a very old-fashioned uniform. And one of their jobs, then there is one whose job is to look after the six ravens. And there have to be six. Can't have seven, can't have five. But if the six ravens leave, that's the end of the crown in England, all right?
Where were there any periods where there was a danger?
Well, no, even
No.
when London was being bombed during the war, no, the six ravens were kept in the Tower of London.
Oh, I didn't know this. It's a wonderful bit small information. Oh, thank you very. That's a very interesting. So I will conclude. Dear friends, I hope you enjoyed this wonderful experience. This was it was a master class presentation from a leader on the subject of intradialytic hypotension. We invite you to stay tuned for more podcasts on very interesting the interesting issues available on many platforms like YouTube, Spotify, and of course the ERA site. Thank you very much. Take care.